Thank you. So, my name is Josh Rosenow. I work at the National Center for Science Education, which is a nonprofit based in Oakland, California, dedicated to defending the teaching of evolution, mostly in the United States, but we do like to joke that we ought to be called the International Center for Science Education, because we tend to get a lot of calls, not just within the U.S., but when something comes up, especially in Turkey or around the world, someone tends to contact us about it, and so we do keep track of these things. And there has been a growth in Turkish creationism as we've been monitoring it. So that's sort of my interest here. But I will say up front, I'm not an Islamist. This is not my area of specialization. I'm going to say things that are wrong or stupid, and you'll correct me in the questions. Okay? Bargain? Excellent. So, the pun in the title here will make sense soon. But one question that I get a lot is, why should we care about the growth of creationism in the Islamic world? Why is that a problem? And I'm going to argue two reasons why this is a concern. The first is that it's an obstacle to accurate science education, especially on evolution, but on a lot of other things. You're taking time away in the curriculum. You're taking sort of mental space away from evolution to this non-scientific idea. And that's problematic. Studying creationism cross-culturally then gives you a way to better understand obstacles to evolution education itself and remove those roadblocks, or at least circumvent them. And the other issue is that creationism is, in many cases, certainly in the United States, and I'm going to argue in Turkey, parasitic on common misconceptions about evolution, common misconceptions about the way science is done. And there's no reason that those misconceptions should be the same in the United States as they are in Turkey. Comparing Islamic creationism, in this case Turkish creationism, to American creationism reveals interesting things about the different cultures, the different ways that people are approaching science, and those are often very useful in helping people come up with better ways to teach evolution, better ways to teach science. You've seen this already, many of you, but again, it bears noting that the United States and Turkey are not as different as we might think, at least in this regard. We're both down there at the bottom of this particular graph, although Turkish acceptance of evolution is still much worse than in the United States, but you know, around 25% acceptance of evolution compared to around 40% in the U.S. A majority of Turks in this poll rejected evolution, whereas it's sort of a third. In American polls, it basically winds up being a third acceptance, a third rejection, and the middle third sort of undecided, more or less. The other question that I get a lot, especially about the U.S., is where does this thing we call creationism come from? Why is it such an American phenomenon? Why is it an increasingly Turkish phenomenon? And it's worth pointing out here that to make a distinction between the doctrine of creation, which is something that is central to all of the monotheistic religions and a lot of others, a lot of Native American, Indian, and so forth religions, the idea that God creates, or that some divine force created the universe. But the doctrine of creationism, this sort of pseudo-scientific structure trying to argue that you can empirically detect the evidence of that creative work, is quite modern. It's something that in the United States dates to the late 19th century, and by the time the Fundamentals were published, from which we get the term fundamentalism, in the 19-teens, you really have the core of creationism set. Common arguments that you see throughout, that you see today, really are established quite early on out of this religious fervor that was going on that also spawned things like the Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, Christian Science, and creationism. This is a photograph from the Scopes trial in 1925. And I'm going to be showing you a lot of quotations from the trial record here. A lot of the arguments, core themes, sort of standard tropes of creationist rhetoric are established by this time, by the 1920s, and you see them still today. What I'm going to be looking at in this talk is how do those same arguments show up in, for instance, the Atlas of Creation, which you've now seen for the third time on the screen. And I chose this because it's so widespread, because it's been relatively successful, at least in the marketplace. And other people who are doing surveys in Turkey can tell us whether the arguments are actually successful in convincing people. But it certainly is getting a lot of attention. People are reading it. People are talking about it. Salman was mentioning that it's been cited in research papers. So the rubric that I'm going to use for the comparison here is the idea of pillars of creation, which is a term that was invented before we were talking about Islamic creationism, but by analogy to the pillars of Islam. And these are common tropes. You can trace them back at least to the Scopes trial, in many cases earlier. They're all, I want to say before I start showing them, they're wrong, but they show up as common arguments and have some, and they're successful in some important way in convincing people. The first is the idea that evolution is a weak science, it's on its way out, it's doomed, going to be replaced by something better any day now. The second of these is the idea that evolution and religion are incompatible, that you have to choose one or the other. And the combination of those first two gives you something that we talk about as the two-model approach, that there's creation and there's evolution. Anything you do that weakens acceptance of evolution strengthens religious faith, and vice versa. So all you have to do to really get people to be more religious is weaken acceptance of evolution. And finally, this sort of classically liberal notion, this individualistic idea that everyone should be able to just decide for themselves. Let's teach kids both sides, because there are only two sides, two-model approach. Teach them both sides and let them make up their own minds. Why should we, through the schools, be forcing them to choose one or the other? So, the first pillar we can trace back. William Jennings Bryan used this on and he was not a young earth creationist. I meant to correct that. His take on the age of the earth is complicated and not worth getting into today. But he is saying, you know, evolution is not true. It's not a truth. Sexual selection has been laughed out of the classroom. Natural selection has been abandoned. And there's no good replacement yet. People are still saying that in the 60s, in 2001. Evolutionists have largely become disenchanted with the fossil record because there are ubiquitous gaps. Evolution is weak. It's on its way out. The intelligent design movement, IDC is the acronym there, saying there's no question that Darwin's theory is creaking and tottering and will implode soon. You know, 80 years after Bryan was saying the same thing. And you have Harun Yahya making the same argument that evolution is an outdated 19th century concept. It's completely collapsed. He's making an even stronger argument. The others are saying it's gonna collapse. It's on the verge of collapse. Harun Yahya, it's over. It's done. Evolution is gone. Let's move on. When we talk about the second pillar here, this is a sort of a nice cartoon representation of how people think about this issue, that evolution is rooted here in unbelief, the soil of unbelief. Biological evolution is growing out of it, producing such fruits as secularism, socialism, communism, racism, hard rock, terrorism. And the solution to these crises in society, these social ills, is the axe of scientific creationism there that's going to chop down the tree of biological evolution, thereby eliminating all of these evil effects and leading people away from unbelief to belief. So you have Bryan in the 20s saying, all of the ills from which America suffers can be traced back to the teaching of evolution, and that it would be better to just only have the Bible. The founder of the young earth, of the creation science movement, Henry Morris, talks about evolution as the foundation of communism, fascism, Freudianism, social Darwinism, behaviorism, Kinseyism, materialism, atheism, in the religious world, modernism, neo-orthodoxy. So, I mean, all of these horrible, horrible things. The godfather of the intelligent design movement, describing how he came to start this form of creationism, said that he started looking at evolution because if it's true, Christian metaphysics is fantasy. This is the two-model approach. This is, you have to choose either evolution or religion. Harun Yahya makes these same sorts of arguments, saying that evolution is just a goal to undermine religious faith, that violent ideologies like racism, fascism, and communism are all drawn directly from evolution, and that the theory of evolution is wrong, therefore the universe was created by God. The two-model approach, that same sort of rhetoric showing up. And this is not surprising that we see these sorts of commonalities. As Tanner was saying, there's a long history of connection between Turkish creationists and American creationism. Books were translated from the ICR, from Henry Morris's organization, into Turkish. And there's a history before that of young earth creationists looking for Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat in Turkey and leaving behind creationist literature of various sorts and building connections. The third pillar is this idea that we should, as we do in so many other fields, just let kids decide. Teach both sides. There are only two sides, two-model approach. Teach both sides, let the kids make up their own mind. In the Scopes trial in the 20s, William Jennings Bryan was saying this. Parents have a right to make up their own mind about what their kids are taught. You know, if they're going to be taught something that's going to reduce faith in God, they should have a say in that. They should just, you know, make their choice. Young Earth Creationism, the book Scientific Creationism, which is a textbook that the Young Earth Creationists produced, is built around this model that if evolution is to be taught, if that must happen, then you should balance it out with creationism. Give equal time to both. This is the fairest thing to do. This idea of fairness is central to the third pillar. Intelligent Design Creationism is all about this. This is a new Intelligent Design Creationist book. It's Explore Evolution. It doesn't even advocate for creationism. The subtitle is The Arguments For and Against Neo-Darwinism. Just present all of the evidence, let kids make up their own mind. And that's what Stephen Meyer is saying here. Good pedagogy commends this approach. It's good science. Teach the controversy. I've looked and looked in Hari Yaya's writings, and I don't see this pillar. I don't see him making this argument. The closest that I've been able to come up with is this from Mustafa Akyol, who was associated early on with Hari Yaya's organization, with the BAV. He's since split with them. He continues to be an advocate for intelligent design creationism in the United States to some extent, and certainly in Turkey. He was invited to testify in science standards hearings in Kansas when I was a graduate student there. He comes close to making a third pillar sort of argument. The first couple sentences here, what is true, what is needed, is just a science education which doesn't try to indoctrinate kids. This is sounding like Stephen Meyer in the last slide. No, don't put it in any particular philosophy. That's necessary for science education. But then he goes off in a very different direction. He says that's also necessary for getting rid of stereotypes, misconceptions about the United States. And then he talks about how the materialism of the United States gives rise to Islamic fundamentalism and terrorism, and that we could, you know, September 11th wouldn't have happened if not for evolution and our teaching. You know, that's the direction he goes with it. Not this individualistic choice that's central to the third pillar, but this sort of social, broad, how societies see one another sort of argument. And it's strange because we know that when the ICR was translating their textbooks into Turkish and providing them to the Ministry of Education in Turkey, that they talk about the books that they were writing were meant to replace evolution-only teaching dominant in their schools with a curriculum teaching the two models, evolution and creation, fairly. That rhetoric was translated over, or at least, I mean, this is in the ICR's own newsletter. You know, maybe they're presenting that differently to their members than they were to the Ministry of Education in Turkey, but still, that rhetoric was there on some level in what they were presenting. It disappears. So what happens to it? Why should it disappear so completely from at least Hari Yaya's rhetoric? Part of it is the political culture of the United States compared to the political culture in Turkey. The United States has this frontier mentality. You should be able to set your own schools up, maintain as much control locally to the community as you can, especially over schools, but really in general. Turkish education is not completely centralized, but the public schools, the curriculum is set nationally. There's not that political culture of keeping things out of the hands of the government when possible and keeping it at the lowest level of the government, failing that. As I understand it, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, the United States has this strong tradition of church-state separation. There are a lot of legal rulings since the 60s saying that you can't teach creationism. So you see name changes like the shift to intelligent design. But even in the 1920s, before there was a lot of that law, you still have William Jennings Bryan making these third pillar arguments as a core of his rhetoric. So there's something more than just legalism there. Part of it, as Tanner was pointing out, is that creationism has a majority in Turkey. Most people in Turkey identify more or less as creationists. So they're in a greater position to simply impose creationism in the schools than in America, where creationism, that term, is, you know, it's sort of the rednecks, it's seen very negatively. So no one wants to identify as a creationist. You want to seem like you're something better, you're just being fair, you're just trying to do this different thing. That may explain part of it. Part of it also comes from perceptions of science. The fundamentalist Christianity is built around this strange sort of Baconian view of science, the idea that you have all of these facts out there laying before you, and by observing them, you can just induce truths from that. That just arise naturally out of the collection of facts. There's not an imposition of theory or whatever onto the process. That's how they approach the Bible. That's the idea of biblical literalism in fundamentalist Christianity. And it's also how they approach these sorts of issues in their writings about evolution. Turkish creationism, my understanding at least, and here again I'm willing to be corrected, the perception of science is more modern. It's not perfect, perhaps, but for instance, you have here Henry Morris saying you have to believe that it's a matter of prejudice one way or the other. Evolution advocates have one set of prejudices, creationists have another, and the thing to do is just lay out the facts and let the truth rise out of that. Whereas Harun Yahya says that the goal is to be freed from prejudice. Anyone without prejudice and the influence of particular ideology will clearly understand that the theory of evolution is impossible. This is almost a sort of Popperian falsificationism that he's at. Not quite, but it's closer to that than to a Baconian approach. So it may be rooted in the particular strange view of science that fundamentalists have. And there's also the issue that I'm most interested in, and I don't know how important it is relative to those others, but that certainly fundamentalist Christianity is quite different from Islam. Fundamentalist Christianity has really thrived in this classically liberal culture, the idea that you can create your own orthodoxy. It can be an orthodoxy of one. A lot of fundamentalists don't go to church because they haven't found the precise church that has the exact same set of ideologies that they think are so important. This is something that's very American. It's sort of the frontier, again, the frontier model, all of these things coming back to it. And it's not about practicing as a community, whereas Islam really is. It's about, you know, the five pillars of Islam are almost all community activities. It's an orthoprax religion where you, it's about how you're behaving in public, it's about the Hajj, it's about charity, these other things are very important to the religious worldview. And that may predispose the religious arguments of creationism against these sorts of classically liberal arguments in favor of, hey, just everyone look at the evidence and make up your own mind. That's, yeah. So, I don't have a book either, but I do have a nonprofit that I work for, and we would always welcome support from people, insights from folks. It's always good to have members, especially outside the United States, who when something comes up, we can contact and say, hey, there's a problem. Would you be willing to help us out and talk to someone? So that's our website, and I'm happy to answer questions. Yeah, I mean, a guy named Glenn Morton has been collecting statements like that going back to... The earliest one that I know of is 1825.
What is the rationale behind it?
It's saying, you know, evolution is wrong, so therefore you should accept this new great thing that I've got. Is the thumbnail sketch of it, I think.
Okay.
Or, but maybe that doesn't...
But I mean, did they have any evidence they're pointing to say, because of this, evolution is dying?
Oh, they'll say the fossil record has all of these gaps in it, so therefore evolution is wrong. And that's the Atlas of Creation, Harnyaya's book. Most of it consists of these beautiful color plates, plagiarized from the very finest of sources, claiming to show that, you know, here's a modern species, although in some cases it's a fishing fly, that looks exactly like this fossil. So therefore, no evolution has happened. The fossil record disproves evolution and proves the fixity of species, perhaps. You know, it's that sort of argument. And they'll point to other things, and you have things like this. You've got Jonathan Wells' Icons of Evolution presenting these arguments that, you know, the peppered moths are all bogus, so therefore evolution is false. Not necessarily very good arguments, but they're arguments. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Do you, from the American scene, which the National Center for Science Education is most closely associated, do you actually get calls, inquiries, and information regarding a specifically Islamic version of creationism in the United States?
We get calls from people who've gotten Harnyaya's Atlas of Creation mailed to them, wondering, what is this? But I can't think of a case of someone contacting us because it's showing up in their schools or because they're feeling like it's being presented to them in a setting that's not appropriate. I can't think of anything like that offhand. But we did get a lot of people calling us when there were threats to ban Richard Dawkins' book in Turkey and things like that. People have all sorts of questions about it.